Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be talking through all the week's security news, and there is a lot of it this week, my God. And then we'll be jumping right on into this week's sponsor interview with Ryan Callumber of Proofpoint. Ryan is a listener, and when he heard Adam talking recently about how password rotations actually result in crappy passwords, like declining entropy for every reiteration of a user's password, it hit a nerve with him. He says Proofpoint, via its CASB product, is seeing a lot of targeted credential stuffing campaigns actually cycling through variations of passwords that have appeared in dumps. Apparently, the bad guys are hip to what a typical password rotation variation looks like, and they're using this knowledge to better direct their cred stuffing attempts. That is a really interesting interview, and it is coming up after the news, which starts now. And Adam, of course, the big story of the week. To be honest, I'm kind of surprised at how big a story it is, but it's this WhatsApp bug that has turned up in the wild being peddled by NSO Group.
Yeah, Facebook announced that a bug was identified in WhatsApp, they claim, by their internal security team. The bug in question has been getting a bunch of coverage because it's like pre-auth remote code exec against the voice calling feature in WhatsApp, and you don't require any user interaction. If you make a call to someone's WhatsApp phone, they don't have to answer it. You get a buffer overflow in the processing of the SRTCP protocol that they use for voice, and then onwards to code exec. And that's a pretty typical sort of bug. But of course, it being used and sold by, you know, for commercial exploitation to intelligence agencies and whoever else, that's really kind of whipped people up into a frenzy, obviously combined with, you know, just the sheer size of the user base of WhatsApp.
Yeah, and we should point out that, you know, NSO's software is being used to target all sorts of the wrong people. We're talking about human rights activists, we're talking about journalists in Mexico, all sorts of stuff. Like, they're, you know, they don't seem to really be controlling who this stuff winds up with. Let's just put it that way. But I just want to play this week's clip, which is a bit of a montage of some of the press coverage there. I mean, this story has been huge. You know, you turn on television, there it is. But also a tangential story here, which is Ayad al-Baghdadi, who is a Palestinian activist who lives in Norway, has actually been put into a form of sort of protective custody, I guess, after a tip-off from the CIA. Which, you know, it seems like MBS in Saudi Arabia is after this guy. He was a colleague and a friend of Jamal Khashoggi. So, I mean, it's just important to keep this in mind. You know, it's all very well and good to have a discussion about bugs, but there's some real stuff happening right now that is quite relevant to this. Anyway, here's how it played out in the media.
Welcome back. WhatsApp hacked. A vulnerability in the app allows spyware to be installed on phones that can turn on the camera, microphone, and collect data.
WhatsApp has discovered a vulnerability that allows remote spyware to be installed on mobile devices.
Top story this morning. WhatsApp says it's found and fixed a major security flaw in the messaging service that allowed hackers to install spyware on mobile phones. Facebook, which owns the company, says the attack targeted a select number of people.
WhatsApp says a security flaw in its messaging system has let hackers gain access to, in its words, a select number of users' phones.
We want to take you now live to Oslo in Norway, where a Palestinian activist who was warned by the Norwegian government of a possible threat against him from Saudi Arabia is holding a press conference for the very first time. This is Ayad al-Baghdadi, who was told the threat had been passed on to Norwegian authorities by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. He was informed there could be several reasons why Saudi Arabia would target him. Ayad al-Baghdadi was granted asylum in Norway 4 years ago and is a critic of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
In closing, I'd like to express my gratitude to Norwegian security services for the care and protection that they have provided. The threats against me seem to be a long-term problem. I'm not in a position to make any comments about security arrangements, but I can confirm that two different Norwegian institutions are involved.
So there you go. I mean, it is interesting times, right? And part of me wonders if the coverage that this one's got could actually turn into a bit of a problem for NSO Group. We've got some human rights organizations actually petitioning an Israeli court. I believe that was supposed to happen today, petitioning an Israeli court to revoke NSO's export license. But when you've got the CIA tipping off the Norwegian government about threats to activists that it's given asylum, and some of these activists have been targeted by NSO, and you got court petitions flying around. You just wonder if maybe in the medium term NSO could be in a bit of trouble here.
Yeah, I mean, they have in the past responded to this criticism, you know, pretty vaguely. They say, you know, we have an ethics committee and we vet who we sell our stuff to. But, I mean, there's a certain limitation to how much a private sector or organization like NSO, you know, to the extent to which they can vet and control, you know, what a customer like the Saudi Arabian government is going to do once they've bought their products. And they could, you know, opt to not sell them to them in the future, which I think is what, you know, Amnesty and some of the other groups pushing the government to revoke their export license would like. But yeah, in the end, what exactly is NSO going to do about it once they've already sold it to an intel agency? You know, it's pretty tough for them to enforce their license agreement there.
Yeah. As for the bug itself, it's really interesting, right? Because everyone's like, oh, it's been patched. But then you look at Checkpoint. Checkpoint did a diff on the patch, right? And looked at where the bug may have resided. And okay, like it's a 90-style buffer overflow and it's all very well and good that WhatsApp have fixed it. But the interesting thing is, you know, this would be a small part of a pretty interesting bug chain. And I don't know if Apple's patched, you know, its relevant bits in this chain. Do you?
No, we don't. And that's certainly one of the hard things about the Apple ecosystem is kind of understanding, because it's so hard to get inside and look at the various gubbins. You know, it's hard to know unless you're a Stefan Esser or something, really what the current state of the exploit mitigations is, and indeed whether or not, you know, you've been hit by this kind of thing. It makes it really difficult. I mean, you would expect that, you know, a buffer overflow probably shouldn't result in code exec, you know, without some other, you know, info leak or a bunch of other things, you know, to make it, you know, viable to get past the exploit mitigation. You know, that shouldn't be a thing these days, but, you know, clearly it is. And then, of course, there's the question of, you know, once you've got code exec inside the context of an app on iOS, you know, then you've got a sandbox escape, you've got to find a kernel bug, you've got to have a bunch of other things, which, you know, you would expect an operator like NSO to have, and, you know, clearly they do. But, yeah, we don't know we're seeing one bug, as you say, of what must be a much larger chain of, you know, of other things.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you mentioned about, you know, the opacity of Apple's iOS. You know, Lorenzo wrote up for Wired. We should mention too, Lily Hay Newman covered this story well for Wired. But Lorenzo has his own piece up, which is saying, you know, sort of stating what is kind of obvious to a lot of people who listen to this podcast, which is that it's very, very difficult to tell if you've actually been targeted by any of this sort of stuff due to the opacity of iOS. And okay, it's all very well and good to say that they should open it up. The problem is, if you open up the operating system to security software, you're kind of opening up a lot of attack surface there as well. That's the dilemma here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really horrible trade-off. I mean, you can have a mobile ecosystem that's really open like Android, and that hasn't made for a less bug-prone platform, right? It maybe has
really?
Made for
no, a... you don't say.
But I mean, maybe it makes for a platform that's easier to do incident response on, and I think that's, you know, a pretty reasonable argument to make. I mean, rolling IR or even just investigating your phone, if something weird happens, I mean, essentially you're just completely screwed unless you're a Dowd or an Esser or someone who's got the necessary tooling to investigate it. Yeah, you've just got nothing. And that's a difficult place to be. But it's hard to see whether the cure for that would be worse than the disease, you know. Although, yeah, you know, opening up maybe would result in more eyes on it, and maybe the price would drop for Apple bugs. I don't know. But yeah, clearly the bugs are still in good supply, and rolling IR and finding those bugs, if you're a group like Citizen Lab, you know, that is responding to dissidents like, you know, Khashoggi getting stuff on their phone, like, it's a really hard thing to do if they're fully patched and you don't have jailbreaks and things ready to go.
You'd think some sort of integrity checking underpinned by the secure enclave, you know, hooks into that. That might be a good idea.
Well, but you would imagine they've already got most of these things, and clearly we still
get bugs.
Yeah,
but you could expose that, right? Like, you could expose, like, some sort of integrity checking function to the outside, and that wouldn't necessarily open up attack surface, like if it's an Apple-implemented feature.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are ways you could approach it, but we just end up in a, you know, trace buster kind of situation, you know, where then you just have to circumvent that as well on your way through. And yeah, it's, you know, these are not easy problems. Like, if they were easy to solve, we would have already done it. And, you know, the iOS environment, like the combination of hardware and, you know, operating system being closed, has produced a more secure than average platform, even though bugs are, you know, still there and, you know, clearly still bad.
Well, I just wish we didn't have irresponsible actors selling these types of exploit chains to countries like Saudi Arabia, who are not using them responsibly. And indeed, you know, I mean, the CIA was motivated enough to give a tip to the Norwegian government about the safety of a refugee living there. I mean, that's how irresponsible Saudi Arabia are, right? Like, it's just nuts. And you'd really hope that NSO is going to get a bit of a rap over the knuckles. And given just the amazing quantity of press coverage, you know, I just kind of feel like it might happen. But you got to imagine, too, they're a company with deep pockets. They're probably greasing all sorts of wheels in Israel.
Well, and also they provide a capability that, you know, a lot of people want. I mean, if you're, you know, if you were really new to NSO Group, like there's a bunch of customers that really don't want that to happen, you know, and maybe consider what's going on as kind of acceptable collateral damage, you know, in their, you know, to maintain their supply chain, which is, you know, shit. But
yeah, well, that's depressing. Thanks, man. Hey, look, we were just speaking about secure enclaves a moment ago. Apparently, now, you know, iOS secure enclave, pretty good. The other iOS, Cisco's iOS, secure enclave on Cisco devices, apparently not so good. Another one from Lily Hay Newman for Wired here.
Yeah, this is an article writing up some research from a company called Red Balloon that have been apparently for a number of years now working on Cisco's kind of hardware trust chain that they have on a bunch of their modern devices. And they dropped a bug this week that it basically lets you reprogram the FPGA that is the trust anchor on Cisco hardware by modifying the bitstream that gets loaded onto the FPGA during startup, which... that's pretty hardcore. I mean, it also kind of makes sense that using something with malleable code as your trust anchor, perhaps not the best choice, which I presume is what Cisco is kind of smacking themselves in the face over right now. But yeah, really interesting piece of research, and it must have been a real hard slog to get through. And of course, the great thing is they paired this particular bug, which kind of requires you to have relatively privileged access on an iOS device to use. They actually paired it with a regular Cisco bug that you could turn into privileged access. So I mean, that was a nice combination for them. But yeah, definitely kind of points the finger at, you know, how good secure, you know, trust anchors have to be these days. And, you know, clearly Cisco has made a bit of a hash of it.
I mean, I'm seeing this one hyped a little, right? But at the end of the day, this is one of those, if you've got root, you can keep root type of deals. I mean, it is a problem, obviously, that this type of, you know, secure boot functionality can be subverted. But it's relatively new to computing anyway, in a mainstream sense. So I don't know that it's the end of the world.
No, it's certainly not, you know, like all of the Ciscos on the planet are going to get hacked by this, you know, kind of thing. And we have seen some reporting that has been hyping it up.
Yes, we have.
which is, you know, is not ideal. And comparing it to some of the more common garden Cisco bugs, you know, like that one we talked about a few weeks ago, you know, pre-auth bug in the login box kind of thing. Like, that's not great. You know, here we're talking about kind of higher-end Cisco gear that has this stuff. But I think the issue here is, you know, A, once you've got root, you can keep it and you can survive across updates and all sorts of other things and, you know, circumvent the one thing that kind of trusted boot is meant to do. So that's one half of it. The other half is that fixing this, like, I'm not quite sure what Cisco are going to do about it. And that's the thing. Like, if it requires you to return your Cisco routers to the factory.
Yeah, we'll just pull that one out of prod for the day, right? Like, that doesn't really work, does it?
Yeah, so bugs like this features like this, I guess, tend to live forever because you're just never going to – that's just never going to happen. So that's one of the other reasons is that, you know, it's going to have a very long tail of utility to attackers.
We've also got some overhyped bugs in the Linux kernel, which is apparently up to version 5.0.8, which made me feel very old when I saw that in the headline.
Yeah, exactly. It does.
Like, we're up to what now?
It certainly does. Yeah, this one really has been rather hyped, way more than it should.
Because, so I mean, the way it's written up, it's like, you know, a TCP/IP stack bug that, like, you know, packet of death, boom, blows up your computer. But it's not that.
Well, no, it's not, basically. You know, some people have been jumping to conclusions because it is in the TCP subsystem, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean remotely triggerable. So this is a bug that essentially it's a use after free in, you know, part of the packet handling and network namespacing in the kernel. My first question was, well, how do I configure the prerequisites in terms of network namespace stuff remotely? Because that's just not how it works. And yeah, we've certainly seen, I mean, I haven't seen exploit for this specific bug yet. And I read the relevant bits of code, but it's kind of really complicated. So I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, some people who are good at this kind of thing have said that this essentially does require you to have either a very specific configuration, which seems unlikely, or enough local access to configure, you know, namespaces and things in a way that would allow you to use this. And that would essentially end up being either a local prev esc or maybe a container escape, you know, if you are running in a Linux container that had the necessary RDS component, which I gather is blacklisted in some of the more modern distributions. So, yeah, this is not the kind of planet-melting Linux kernel TCP stack remote that we all dream of, you know, and there hasn't been one of those for a long time. And it's kind of irresponsible to see the reporting, you know, making that implication, you know, without really the very strong evidence that you would want to back that up. Like, it's an extraordinary claim. I want to see more than just the CVSS scores repeated, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they gave it a really low exploitability on the CVSS. So, you know, that's the thing that made me double take when you look at some of the hysterical commentary about this, and then you see, well, what CVSS, you know, exploitability 2, you know, okay, something's not gelling here.
It's certainly not the worst bug of the day.
No, and what's crazy, right, is like we rarely talk about like bugs. Like, you know, Risky Biz isn't the bugs show. But this week, I mean, the whole top half of the show is all about bugs because there's just been so many. And, you know, a real lack of clarity out there in the media about which ones are serious and which ones aren't. But holy dooly, Adobe dumped a patch. How many CVEs? I mean, holy God, man, this is a serious patch. 84 vulns.
So they patched 84 vulns just in Acrobat Reader. Of which
I'm seeing a lot of the word critical.
Like 50 odd. I did count, but I forget because it was such a big number. 50 something of that 84 are like code exec, and the rest are info leaks that help you get code exec. which is just
is this have they been doing some internal work? Because I mean, that's usually what happened. Like when you see a patch like this, it's usually because they've dug it up themselves.
You would certainly hope so, but then again, I mean, maybe there's just still that many people finding that many bugs in Acrobat. I'm amazed that there are that many bugs still to patch in that thing. Like, I mean, you would have thought it'd be mined dry by now. You can't imagine that they introduced a lot of new code into Acrobat at this point in its life. Like, where are all these bugs coming from?
Where are they coming from? But hey, they're not even the bad ones this week because Microsoft's Patch Tuesday dropped, and wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some good ones this week from Microsoft. Where do we even begin? I guess the big one is they're patching out an RDP remote, Microsoft Terminal Services remote desktop, a remote pre-auth remote in that going back to like XP and before. They're patching back to XP and 2K3 even, which gives you an idea of how seriously they're taking it. Pre-auth remote code exec in RDP. Like, that's a bad one. Microsoft's describing it as wormable, which...
Yeah. An RDP worm. I mean, really, because we've seen a few of these, right? Like, we've seen a few actual network worms thanks to, you know, SMBv1 and stuff. But an RDP worm, why not? And you can imagine, like, not all of these are going to get patched quick enough. I would not be surprised to see something hose them this week, CryptoMiner or something like that. And that's the thing, right? Like, there's a motivation for people to actually launch network worms now.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you can make money out of a network worm definitely increases the chance that we're going to see it happen again. And an RDP one, man, there is so much RDP on the internet.
Well, this might fix that.
it may well. But yeah, it's interesting because we haven't really seen over the years a lot of RDP bugs. I mean, there's been what? There was one that was dumped in one of the, was it the Shadow Brokers had an RDP bug, and then there was kind of hints of another one. This particular bug appears to have come out of GCHQ. Microsoft credits the NCSC with this bug. So
spill the rumor.
Well, I mean, we saw mentions of a bug in RDP in, I think it was either Shadow Brokers or one of the other ones that just never kind of materialized. And of course, the question is this one of the spook world bugs that's finally kind of been vuln equities'd out of GCHQ and into getting fixed? You know, because how many years have they been rolling around with these? Because they've clearly had RDP bugs for a while in the spook world, and out here in Unclass, we hadn't seen so many of them.
You would think, that something – look, I would have expected that a bug like this in RDP, you kind of would have hoped that it would have been vepped a little bit sooner than after they've had, you know, 10 years of use out of it.
Well, I mean, it's just really useful, you know?
Sure is.
Wants to be the white hat bug killer. You know, everyone wants to pop shells and get glory and, you know, tasking and whatever else that they do with their bugs. But, yeah, this one is killed. Of course, the patches are going to get reversed, like – instantly, and if it is in fact as juicy a bug as you would expect, then great. We might actually see it wormed.
Look, if our voice connection on this call starts slowing down, we know why, right?
One thing is worth noting about the RDP bug is we have seen some reporting saying it doesn't affect more modern Windows, i.e. the ones that use network-level authentication. So in the case of boxes with NLA, modern Windows, I do gather that it is still vulnerable, of course, but now it's requires authentication. So any level of auth that gets you to get past NLA is still probably enough to then trigger the bug, I think is what I read. So yeah, just worth keeping in mind if you have more modern Windows and were thinking you didn't need to patch fast.
TechCrunch has a story up here, which just, it's just a depressing stat, right? They say 2 years after WannaCry, there are a million computers still at risk to like that horrible old, you know, Eternal Blue SMBV1 exploit. That just blows my mind.
And that's a million boxes that are vulnerable to it that have probably already been owned. I mean, you know, they're not sitting around there not owned, and they can't, this research is based on, I think, stats from Shodan, which can't really tell if they've been already owned, you know.
But yeah, I mean, they have to be, right? Like, they would have to be.
They pretty much do have to be. And yeah, I mean, I'm always surprised at how few groups, and this is foreshadowing somewhat, do actually go around finding all this stuff and just kind of bundle it up and sell access to the organizations that you can get from there, because it would seem like a sensible way to make money. But
well, this actually is something that comes up in this week's sponsor interview with Ryan Callenberg, because he's saying, like, you know, when we were talking about things like Norsk Hydro and whatever, some of these high profile ransomware attacks, I mean, quite often these days, people are just buying access from someone who's shelled a box at a corporation. You know, they'll buy the access and then they'll roll ransomware on it, right? So, yay.
Well, and I think you're right there that the key is something like ransomware where you can actually monetize it, because previously there wasn't a great way to justify buying access. And now there is, you know, financial incentive fixes everything. It.
So one of the things I love about my job is when a story like this comes up, this next one, I have no hope of basically understanding it, because it is way beyond my abilities to understand something like this. And I know that all I have to do is send the news article to you and you're going to read the paper and explain it to me. Tell us about the Zombie Load side channel attacks.
Yeah, so a bunch of researchers have been pulling the thread on the kinds of speculative execution and, you know, kind of cache side channel, microarchitectural side channel attacks that have been in vogue for the last couple of years. And the academic community is really good at pulling the thread on this kind of bug. So we've seen, kind of two or three related techniques dropped as one bug that we won't name, because we don't name bugs. And this one is actually, it's kind of more interesting than average. This is essentially a bug where, in the case where you've got execution on the same CPU core but in a different hyperthread, you can leak the contents of some of the memory load, like a microarchitectural memory load buffer. So you can kind of cause, so the thing you'd like to steal data from is in the middle of doing a load. You on the other core kind of trigger a load that forces an exception to occur on the CPU and causes a slow path to happen. And then whilst that slow path in the microarchitecture is happening, rolling back your instruction, you can kind of read from the load buffer of the other thread and then use that to kind of leak data out. And it's quite a slow leak, but the researchers did some good work in, you know, trying to adapt the technique to be genuinely useful and do some kind of sampling. And the attacks are being referred to as microarchitectural data sampling attacks for this reason. That's what makes it viable. And we've seen, you know, some quite compelling demos for this. You know, for example, there's one where someone was reading the contents of the root password hash on a Unix box.
Well, that's useful.
Which is useful, but of course, the like all of these things, like doing them in a lab environment, in a controlled environment, is quite different than doing them in the wild. And you don't get any control over what data you're reading unless you can influence what the other core, the other half of the core is doing. So if you wanted to do this across a virtual machine boundary, for example, perhaps you can repeatedly try to log in or repeatedly connect to a network service that's processing cryptographic functions like, you know, TLS or SSH or something, so that the key material is constantly being loaded into memory, and then you hit it on the other core and you can leak some bytes out. So in that context, it could be a really powerful bug. But of course, in the real world where servers are busy and other things are going on, you're going to have a lot more error. And the researchers work in reducing that error through sampling and statistical techniques is really interesting as a general kind of thing to read. But so yeah, it's a more interesting than average microarchitectural bug.
In terms of fixing this, like how do you go about, you know, fixing this? Is this an entire new class of vulnerability, and we're going to see, you know, more and more variants popping up that could need to be continuously patched, or is this something we can just knock on the head immediately?
the previous work to address, you know, speculative execution bugs and the other side channels hasn't really affected this particular one. It's kind of a variant that looks at a different part of the microarchitectural parts of Intel CPUs. So Intel's known about this, I think, for about a year now. So they have released a bunch of microcode patches. Microsoft have released some patches for Windows to work around it, similarly for OS X, and we'll see it percolate out into the Linux kernel. Really, the main thing here, and I think a lot of people would have already done this in response to the previous ones, is hyper-threading is key here. The fact that you're sharing a single CPU core's resources is what enables this to be practical, and I am sure that most people who care about this stuff already turned off hyper-threading just because it's a terrible idea for this kind of thing anyway. So that's the easy one. It's just turn it off. I mean, if you've got a workload that really needs hyper-threading, then, you know, think about what that means in terms of your security model. But other than that, that's the easy thing to do.
Yeah. SHA-1 collision attacks are apparently becoming quite practical. I mean, no surprise here. We've been seeing large, you know, technology companies deprecating SHA-1 for quite a while and saying we're not going to support it. And, you know, it looks like that's turned out to be quite prescient advice.
Yeah, and obviously the world of crypto kind of marches inexorably onwards when you start getting this, you know, past a certain threshold of weakness, you know, with a cipher or with a hash function. And that's really what's happening here. The big change that we've seen now is the previous attacks we saw against SHA were not chosen prefix. You couldn't just kind of generate arbitrary collisions easily. This work does demonstrate generating hashes, matching hashes for data with chosen prefixes, which makes it much more useful if you're trying to, you know, fake a certificate or fake bypass some other, you know, packet signing or some other integrity checking routine. So that's the thing here. We're still talking in the order of, you know, $100,000 worth of compute time to do on average. So that, I mean, it's not a small attacker's kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like 100K to be able to forge a SSL certificate, right? Like, I can think of quite a few organizations that would happily pay that sort of cash to be able to do it. But, you know, you're not going to get, I'm guessing, certificates for major services. Like, you're not going to get someone's Gmail this way, right? Because they're not going to be doing, you know, SHA-1 SSL certs, right?
No, I mean, this is why we've spent so much time deprecating it, you know, early enough in the cycle that it wouldn't hit this point and us still be really relying on it. But of course, there will still be places where SHA-1 is critical, and those places need to check themselves before they get wrecked.
Some real, real horrible NVIDIA, like, you know, graphics driver bugs here, which just look like Privesque gold.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, in general, if you land on someone's gaming box with NVIDIA drivers, you're going to have a good time. And there's been a bunch of bugs in NVIDIA's stuff over the years. They're not known for really robust, you know, kind of security-centric engineering.
But I thought NVIDIA, you know, graphics cards wind up in a lot of boxes, not just, you know, high-end gaming rigs. Like, you know, you're going to see those drivers in all sorts of spots, aren't you?
So that is a good question, actually, how to what extent these apply to compute, you know, GPU compute NVIDIA gear, stuff you might see in data centers or Amazon. I don't know that any of these are, I mean, most of this is in Windows stuff, and you don't tend to not see the Windows drivers on, you know, cloud graphics compute, but there may well be, you know, similar sorts of bugs. That would be an interesting piece of research. Yeah. Of course, you know,
but it's just funny, right? When you've got, like, you know, a really advanced OS full of mitigations and stuff, and then you just got these terrible, like, highly privileged drivers that are just absolutely woeful.
Yeah, and it's a bad place to be in, but I guess, you know, this is why you don't cross the streams and use your gaming box to do your banking.
Now, this one, Adam, this one here is like by far, with everything, even though there's all this high impact news this week, this one is by far the funniest story I think I've seen in quite a lot of time, and I knew you would get a kick out of it as well. Please just tell the listeners what the hell I'm talking about.
This is a beautiful thing. How many of you, dear listeners, have been out shopping on the internet and have gone to one of those kind of sites that has a, like, one of those security seals that says this thing has been scanned by so-and-so and is hacker-proof? And you've gone, well, that sure makes me feel better not. Turns out one of the companies that does this, called Best of the Web, totally reliable name there. Yeah, their, like, JavaScript site seal thing, like the CDN that served it, appears it got kind of owned and had not one, but two JavaScript keyloggers shoved into the site's safe, hacker-proof seal JavaScript.
Which means that anyone displaying the seal was dropping JavaScript keyloggers all over that page, right? And where do those seals tend to pop up? On the payment pages.
Oh, dear.
Isn't it beautiful, though?
It is. It's just a beautiful thing.
Like, beautiful. I just, you know, you got to hope, though, that the person doing it was aware of the irony. You know what I mean? Like, you really hope that they got a chortle out of it.
They must have been. They must have been. I also got a chortle out of the response from the vendor to Bleeping Computers article about this. I didn't get to ask them about it. And the team who responded are the Best of Web Trust SEAL team, which sounds a lot more paramilitary than perhaps the intended. Yeah, exactly. That sort of SEAL. Oh, dear.
Now, look, it looks like a few large AV companies, we're talking about Symantec, Trend Micro, and McAfee. There's some pretty credible claims flying around that they got owned pretty hard via, it looks like, RDP as well, which makes it sort of double funny. Walk us through this one, because I got in touch with Trend. Disclosure, they're a sponsor. They put out a statement that appears in this story. They're not really adding to it. There's a little bit of disagreement as to just how hard they got owned. Attackers are claiming, yeah, they got Trend sourced. Trend saying no. Symantec's denying it completely. I think McAfee's silent. But this is pretty... Look, my take on this is it's embarrassing. But walk us through the actual story here, Adam.
Yeah, so Bleeping Computer has been talking to a crowd called Advanced Intel that are hanging out on a bunch of Russian crime forums where there were some conversations going on offering to sell access to a bunch of US antivirus vendors or antivirus vendors in general. And they were claiming to have sufficient access to the network to steal source code to a bunch of products and were kind of, you know, trying to make some deals to flog that off. There's some translations of the Russian forums that kind of talk about, you know, the nature of the access, that they've been working for a while on getting access to some of these companies and were in a position to, you know, jack significant amount of source code. The amount of access they've had to the company seems to be a bit different. The Symantec/Norton one, Symantec's kind of come back and said, you know, we didn't, you know, there has been, you know, we've seen some signs, but there's not anything interesting going on. And Advanced Intel have kind of said that is corroborated by some of the evidence that they've got. Whereas, say, Trend Micro, it appears that they're all up in there and have a whole bunch of access, you know, to source code for products and all that kind of thing. And there does seem to be some.
Well, and Trend's response is, oh, they owned some like inconsequential lab and they're overhyping it and stuff. But Advanced Intel are like, yeah, no.
Yeah. I mean, this crew does seem to be selling, like, you know, here's TeamViewer access to the domain controller kind of thing. So yeah, that's not a, you know, not a small, you know, middle of nowhere lab with some rubbish stuff on it. But then again, some of the other bits do seem a little bit weird, but you know, badly translated Russian crime forum messages, you know, maybe there's something lost there. But either way, you know, the idea that antivirus companies are a target, you know, makes a lot of sense. Access to the source of the products really useful for, you know, a whole bunch of reasons, you know, making your tooling avoid antivirus, finding bugs in the antivirus itself.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't need the source to be able to do that, right? Like, you just don't. And I guess, you know, for me, the primary concern here would be if this was, you know, if they did have access to repos, if they were actually looking to do some supply chain shenanigans with it. But there's no suggestion that that's occurred. And you'd hope checks prior to, you know, signing and shipping would actually catch any of that sort of subversion.
You would hope, but of course, once you're in a position like this, you know, all of that stuff,
it's party time.
It's just kind of engineering, you know? And I think, you know, talking about source code, like offering source code for sale on the forums really is just a way of saying, like, we have everything. You know, it's the thing you pick out to say that we've got, that is the kind of crown jewel, as opposed to saying, oh, we've got access to the signing box.
But we saw a Symantec source code leak a few years ago as well, didn't we? It's ringing a bell.
There's been a few over the years, you know, various products leaking out. And it's always, you know, there are always interesting, you know, niches of bugs to go find in some of those products.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I think Bleeping Computers, where I first became aware of this, and I've seen it sort of pop up in a couple of different places, but I think this is still like a developing story, which is why we haven't seen it written up absolutely everywhere. Meanwhile, and this is an interesting story, Wired's got this one, another one from Lily Hay Newman. She's had a very busy week. The Anthem breach. I mean, the accepted wisdom was that this was a Chinese government joint, right? The Anthem breach back in 2015. That was when we first found out about it. We've seen a couple of indictments here. The Department of Justice has unsealed an indictment against two Chinese gentlemen, but there is nothing in the indictment that suggests they're government operators. It's all a little bit strange.
Yeah, we have seen, you know, a couple of individuals named who have some association with, you know, a crew that has done kind of, you know, Chinese government hacking. But yeah, there's not a... I mean, the
they're
same
not spelling it out in the indictment. I think that's the interesting part, right?
Yeah, and there's also no suggestion, you know, kind of why, like what, whether the data was subsequently used for something or what the intrusion was for and whether or not it was in their, you know, in these gentlemen's capacity as, you know, kind of operating on the behalf of the Chinese government or whether it was some other, you know, kind of free market enterprise. I mean, because a lot of the Chinese crews are, you know, a little bit flexible as to whether, you know, where they get their jobs from. And so, yeah, we don't really, yeah, it is, it's all a bit up in the air as to exactly what this means.
So this next one, the reason I've included it, right, I initially, because I pulled together all of the news, right, and I sort through it and I close a lot of it, you know, shut down the tabs and that goes in the bin and that goes in the bin. I binned this one and then I brought it back because I think it was a really interesting moment where I thought the crippling of the Baltimore city government by ransomware wasn't even worth discussing because it's so routine. And that sort of gave me this moment of like, wow, that's where we are, that this is barely even newsworthy. But yeah, Baltimore City, their computers have basically all been shut down. They're rolling from backup. I don't think it affected emergency services, but this is where we are, isn't it, as a discipline?
It is a really strange place to be that is not newsworthy. Wow.
Yeah. You see what I mean, right? Like, I bet you saw this story and you're like, what's that one doing in there? Seems pretty routine, right?
Well, actually, the thing that I pulled out of the story that I thought, you know, I thought, well, what am I going to talk about this one? Because it's such a routine story. The thing that I pulled out that I thought was interesting is that this particular set of malware is actually manually deployed. Like, it's not the sort of thing that self-propelled malware can deploy. A human, there's not enough steps involved in deploying it that a human has to do it, which means that a human attacker is up in Baltimore's business actually doing this by hand, which is kind of a different thing than self-propelled, you know, kind of network malware.
That comes up in the interview that's running next. Julian Assange, list of things to worry about has grown. Swedish prosecutors want to reopen the rape investigation into Julian Assange. So it looks like we're set for a bit of an extradition showdown in the UK over the next year as Swedish and US authorities sort of compete to take custody of him.
Yeah, apparently there was still a couple of years to run on the kind of limitations for when they had to you know, kind of do it in Sweden. I gather the UK government, you know, is required to kind of, you know, consider a bunch of things when they're choosing which, you know, kind of request for extradition takes precedence. You know, there's some aspect of the actual crime, there's some aspect of just who asked first. So yeah, we'll see what the future holds for Julian.
Well, I mean, he's currently in prison for skipping bail related to this charge. So you do wonder how it's going to play out, right? And you sort of wonder what would be a worse outcome for him. Because I think if he goes to the United States, he's going to do 5 years in Club Fed and then emerge, you know, still with this sort of rebel hero thing around him, right? Whereas if he goes to Sweden and there's open testimony about his alleged sexual assaults, you know, he's probably going to do, okay, let's just say the same amount of time or maybe even less in a Swedish prison, but you would imagine that his reputation would take a bit more of a hit than if it were just the US charges.
And of course, there's also no reason that he couldn't then go onwards from Sweden to the US afterwards. I mean,
I believe there is actually, because if they extradite him to Sweden, then he cannot be extradited onwards to the United States. That's not how this works.
Okay, well, that is an important data point that I did not know about international extradition arrangements.
Yeah, but I mean, that was the one that he was always using. That's why he said he went to the embassy, is because if he went to Sweden, he'd wind up in the States, and it's not true. So look, it's all pretty interesting. And I think, you know, if he does wind up in Sweden, one thing that's going to be very interesting to me is seeing how these allegations play out again. I think I mentioned this on the show before, seeing how these allegations play out in a post-Me Too world, right? Because obviously the allegations were first leveled at him before that movement, which I think really has changed the dynamic of sexual assault reporting. So that's one to keep an eye on. We have a former NSA analyst who's been charged with leaking documents to The Intercept. They're facing up to 50 years in prison. And it looks like the stuff they leaked were the so-called drone papers that wound up being written up, you know, by Jeremy Scarhill and co. over at The Intercept, which does look like, you know, to me, looks like public interest reporting.
Yeah, I mean, of all of the leaks we've seen over the years, this one does seem perhaps you know, more defensible than average. Yeah. You know, the reporting from The Intercept on the Obama era, you know, kind of, you know, extrajudicial drone killing program, you know, was pretty shocking and, you know, did feel like good reporting. And The Intercept did a, you know, I thought a pretty good job. I went back and reread, you know, a couple of the pieces.
Yeah, me too.
You know, whilst we were preparing here. Yeah. And yeah, it
was you very, and I had the same instinct to do that today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got to, you know, think about the context of what those stories brought at the time, which, you know, people, you know, there was much less public consciousness of what those drone programs looked like.
And that's the thing, that reporting gave us a real sort of visibility into a fairly consequential government program, right? And the US government was not exactly being forthcoming about its drone program. So it does really feel like this one, you know, may have moved the policy needle about a little bit. And, you know, you just hope the guy doesn't get 50 years. Although, you know, leaking that sort of material when you, you know, TSSCI, that's, you know, it's going to be a big deal. He's going to prison for sure.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. The guy is, his name is Daniel Hale. He worked at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency after a stint in the Air Force. And yeah, apparently he was, you know, kind of photocopying some of these documents and taking them home the old fashioned way. And he was also found with a USB stick full of classified docs and a second USB stick next to it with Tor and Tails on it, which, you know, a bit of a giveaway.
That's kind of the smoking gun right there. And, you know, we'll just see if the sentencing winds up in line with, you know, the other Intercept leaker reality winner. I think she got 6 years in the end. So you would think, you know, they this guy will be lucky to get 6 years, but that seems to be approximately where the sentencing has sat for that crime. Oh, man, Iran's still getting shadow brokered.
Yeah, the crew that's been dropping stuff on Telegram and other places around the internet has dumped a bunch of details about some of the other parts of the Iranian hacking crew. We've seen some screenshots of information for sale with, you know, like C2 control panels. And we've seen some information about targeting. There were some screenshots of, you know, almost like a presentation of where they were going around targeting. I was pleased to note Australia and New Zealand on the targeting list in the other category. So, you know, at least we rated something.
Yeah, look, I have no doubt they're active everywhere, basically, because they've been very naughty, Iran, you know, but they're still getting shadow brokered, and it's quite funny. lots again this week from Bleeping Computer. You know, they really do fill in a nice gap that other outlets miss. So well done to the crew at Bleeping Computer. And one more from them says that Nigerian business email compromise scammers are shifting to remote access trojans as a tool of choice. I mean, this is something we've been seeing over a period of time, but I do find it interesting that, you know, those Nigerian crews are actually getting up that skill chain, right?
Yeah, and I think it makes a lot of sense that, you know, as email systems are becoming more complicated and as banking systems are becoming more complicated, you know, multi-factor auth and all sorts of extra kind of levels of things, it is becoming harder to do with just mailbox access. So being able to leverage up and, you know, have a bit more access to understand the context is going to help with the success rates of your scams. And, of course, there's loads of options for, you know, cheap remote access trojans so that they can rely on. Yeah, so it makes sense to kind of upskill, get a bit more value out of your customers.
Oh, now apparently Mozilla is pulling together some grant money for people to look for someone to look at integrating Tor with Firefox. And, you know, I remember going for a bushwalk in Africa with Roger Dingledine, as you do. And, you know, it really seemed like even back then that when you flicked on private browsing, this is kind of what Roger had in mind. You know, instead of just, we're not going to record your cookies, like just turning on Tor by default for private sessions. So it looks like Mozilla could be moving in that direction. And that could be very interesting.
Yeah, they've got a grant program up to investigate a bunch of different ways to improve privacy and you know, security in Firefox, of which integrating Tor to become the kind of, you know, they call it what, like super private browsing mode as a sort of an amusing name for it, you know, is one of the ways that you could go about doing that. And it does seem to make a lot of sense, right, to leverage this right into the browser. I mean, of course, people are going to have some concerns about, you know, the kind of the tighter the coupling between the really private bit and the regular bit, the more options there are for information leaks. And other things to go wrong that would kind of, you know, lower the quality of the segregation. But, you know, in terms of exposing a whole bunch more people to using Tor in a way that, you know, if they can even get it up to the level of running a separate Tor browser, like the Tor browser bundle as a completely separate executable, you know, if they can make it that easy, then they'll definitely get a whole bunch more people using it. And also, of course, you know, the Tor browser bundle uses the older versions of Firefox. And
well, this is the bit that I was going to talk about is like every time there's a patch in Firefox, you know, you've usually got a bit of lead time to reverse it. and, you know, roll out your, you know, FBI network investigative techniques, you know, via a week old Firefox vuln, because of course, you know, the Tor browser bundle, they need to engineer those patches into that bundle, right? So putting it actually in the browser makes a lot of sense. I don't think the FBI will like it though.
No, I imagine they probably won't, but they've lost the crypto wars, right? So they'll just have to deal with it.
Yeah, they will. And I've got an interview coming up in the next few weeks with Jim Baker, who was the lead counsel for the FBI during Comey's time there. And, you know, of course, he was the head lawyer for the FBI at the time the San Bernardino thing unfolded. That's going to be a really interesting chat. Him and I have had a conversation about the interview that we're going to do, which I think is next week or the week after. And yeah, that's going to be really good. It's that's one of the Hewlett Foundation podcasts that they've sort of commissioned me to do. So do keep an eye out for that one. Another one from Motherboard here from Joe Cox, which is there's some sort of crypto panel looking at standards and whatever, and some group of Russian cryptographers have come up with this thing, and the rest of the panel is like, hey, that kind of looks like it's backdoored, and the Russians are like, no, that's totally a coincidence.
We would never.
So it sort of looks reminiscent of the whole drama around the BSafe stuff, you know, and the NSA and NIST and blah, 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 blah. But this is why we have panels, right?
Yeah, this is exactly why we have this kind of review. And of course, cryptographers really love this kind of thing. I mean, this is exactly their jam, you know, spotting other cryptographers trying to be sneaky with and put backdoors in the standards. They love that. And so I think everyone's having a great time, you know, kind of trying to figure out
accusing each other of being subversive weirdos.
Yeah, well,
you know?
Exactly. Like, yeah. And I mean, there are some reasonable counter arguments that the kind of properties of the S boxes of these ciphers that they're claiming may be advantageous to, you know, the kinds of cryptographic backdoors, you know, sort of exist. Many of the same properties exist in some of the other ciphers that are S-box based. So, you know, the cryptographers are just having a whole bunch of fun. I think it's the main thing that's happening here. No one outside of Russia probably is going to deploy Russian government standard ciphers unless they need to interop with the Russians. But yeah, cryptographers, you know, totally having a fine time.
Microsoft keeps belting out sensible advice lately, and their latest is that, you know, you really should be doing your administrator tasks on dedicated hardware. And look, you know, seems like good advice to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the guidance from Microsoft about kind of high assurance Active Directory environments, you know, really has been pretty good over the years and is absolutely better than it used to be. And this one really is pushing the idea of having, you know, separate privileged admin workstations, you know, that are dedicated hardware for doing administrative tasks so that you can keep your day-to-day corp life away from your domain admin life. And of course, it's also recommending, as they have done in the past, that you have a, you know, separate Active Directory forest with separate infrastructure that you log into to do the admin thing. And then that provisions you just-in-time access for administrative access into the more, you know, corporate lower trust domain. But very few people are willing to wear the cost of that. I mean, yeah. And not just individual companies, but all of the outsource providers. I mean, the idea here that you would have, you know, imagine if you're an outsource provider that's managing domains for 100 customers. Are you supposed to have 100 different separate admin boxes, like for that sort of environment, which is where a lot of the supply chain attacks are focusing, you know, on systems integrators and upstream, you know, management firms, you know, in those environments, this advice just doesn't really fly. And that's, you know, it's good advice for individual corps, but it is more complicated than that for, you know, some of the sorts of customers that we see that have, you know, more unique requirements.
And I guess our skateboarding dog this week is, you know, about the unfortunate citizens of Panama. Well, 85% of them anyway had their personal data exposed via an exposed Elasticsearch.
Yeah, some organization, as yet unnamed, had loaded data about 85%, something, you know, 3 million people's worth of like medical data, but there was no actual patient information, but it was clearly from a medical system with names and addresses and, you know, social security numbers or the equivalent in Panama, a bunch of that kind of, you know, personal data, all loaded up into Elasticsearch and just left on the internet like you do with Elasticsearch so that everybody can search it.
But I mean, that's the problem, right, is when you can easily handle that much data, people get careless with it because they just zap it from here to there and then, hey, let's spin up a test instance for this latest thing for searching that data. And yeah, that's how it happens.
Exactly right. I mean, I would not be surprised if this was one of the like Amazon Elasticsearch in the cloud or some Elastic as a service that, because it is so easy to spin up, everybody does it and then they don't all get spun down.
Yeah. Well, mate, that is actually it for the week's news. What a monster session. Thanks a lot for joining us. And of course, we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, certainly was a lot this week. And hopefully we'll have a quiet one next week. Thanks very much, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Callumber. He is Proofpoint's EVP of cybersecurity strategy. He was formerly the SVP. Now he's an EVP. The S has changed to an E. But yes, he is the EVP of cybersecurity strategy at Proofpoint. And we'll be touching on a few things with Ryan this week. He says attackers are pulling passwords out of dumps and then working through typical forced password rotation variations. So like, let me in one, let me in two, let me in three. And this process is now automated and everyone's doing it, apparently. So yeah, Ryan and I speak about that. Then we also talk about what's happening with ransomware. Is mass ransomware via email still dead? You know, have we moved to manual targeting? You'll hear what he has to say about that in just a moment. Here's Ryan Callumber.
One of the things that we've done when we moved to the cloud is made that extraordinarily easy to do at scale. So it seems pretty clear at this point when I look at our data, which we get from our Cloud Access Security Broker product, that pretty much everybody's being targeted here. We saw it in about 72% of the 1,000-plus tenants that we monitor. And shockingly, about 40% of the time, an attacker is successful at compromising at least one account via this technique, even when there's MFA in place on all of the obvious protocols.
Yeah, because there's some other protocols there that don't really play nice with MFA.
Absolutely. I mean, IMAP is the big one that these guys like. There's, of course, ActiveSync. You know, you see all these funny logins from mobile email clients, and even things like Exchange Web Services, which are extraordinarily hard to get rid of. You know, when your CIO tells you got to go to Office 365, oftentimes that happens. It's a huge lift to do that. And these things just don't really get factored in. And MFA on the front door is fantastic. But as the old saying goes, if you don't have MFA everywhere, you don't have MFA.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what is a typical, I mean, what do you call this? It's not really credential stuffing, but it's like, would you call this like informed guessing? I mean, that seems a maybe a way to put it.
For a while, we were playing around with targeted credential attacks. Targeted password spraying is another good way to characterize it. Because, of course, it exists at slightly different scales depending on who your adversary is. It is a very clear thing. In our data that you have Nigerian kind of BEC actors doing this prolifically. And then we see other times only one or two accounts get targeted by incredibly persistent attackers who will just keep guessing on these protocols until they get access to what they want. Those things, I think, fit pretty neatly into what I would call targeted password spray attacks.
Now, you know, there is a dictionary attack, there is a brute force attack, but what you're describing here is something, you know, in addition to that, which is really they will take a password from a public dump, right, which has been a standard thing that people have done for a while. But even if it doesn't pan out, they start guessing on variations of that. Like, what sort of variations do they try?
It's a really good point, actually, because the variations are unbelievably simple because we are unbelievably simple human creatures and we iterate in predictable ways. So the classic ones that
iterating
that
the number on the end, I'm guessing,
iterating the number on the end, yeah. Iterating the special character right after the number. You know, is go Yankees one? No, go Yankees one exclamation point, or go Yankees one bang? Go Yankees two at sign. Go Yankees three pound sign. It depends how much time has gone by because you might have gotten all the way through the nine cardinal numbers there, but it really does seem that people, when they have to correspond to those password policies that Adam mentioned, you know, they get more and more predictable over time. And we've seen attackers actually start to be successful with fewer and fewer guesses the more public credential dumps there are. So there's a big, big spike in this sort of activity right after the dump came out in the conventional credit collection number one dump came out a couple of months ago. And when that was quickly followed on, we saw another spike in activity. And it does seem to be incredibly successful and low tech, even with very limited tooling on the attacker side.
It's funny, right? Because that collection number one, that was mostly an aggregation of other dumps, right? So it just shows that people are quite lazy. And even though that data was already out there, they're like, huh, someone's put it together, may as well use it.
Exactly. December was actually the biggest month we've ever seen, which is unusual because things like targeted phishing attacks, the malware landscape, it all tends to go on holiday like all of the rest of us because they have fewer people that are going to click on their lures. These attacks actually went up as the holidays occurred, because frankly, you know, people were probably not monitoring in quite the same ways. And collection one gave people a tremendous amount of raw material to work with in targeting these things.
So I'm guessing this means that you are, as I said in the intro, broadly supportive of the of Microsoft's push to sort of maybe get people to select one good password rather than changing it all the time.
Absolutely. We, in fact, changed our own policy at Proofpoint recently, and there was much rejoicing when we did that. I think the ultimate goal is to move away from passwords entirely, and everyone endorses that, but there's so much that would be broken by that, that we just have to move in incremental steps. I think that the main thing that we're paying attention to now, though, is that when you move to Office 365 or G Suite, you are really at risk for this sort of an attack, and what gets endangered when a credential like this gets compromised is pretty staggering, right? The entire global address list, the ability to access that person's email, all of their files. We've centralized so much access in this one credential that these attacks are incredibly useful for adversaries who are most of the time financially motivated, but have a whole wealth of options at their disposal after they compromise an account like this.
I would think, though, that, you know, if you're going to stop rolling passwords over every, you know, X number of days, you'd really want to drum into your workforce that the password that they're using has to be substantially unique, right? Because of the password dump problem. Because that's the one thing that, you know, about fixed passwords that, I mean, they're all well and good unless they're being reused elsewhere, right? And then they're very, very bad.
Absolutely. And I think whenever there is anything that's accessible from the internet that depends on a single factor, even if you do make progress on this particular issue, which is just highlighted by the ease with which external attackers can compromise accounts that they go after in a targeted way with barely functional tooling, you know, what really jumps out to me is that, you know, some of the data that we've seen or that we're seeing is that even if you do have MFA in place, the rate of compromise goes down by about 2/3. But the question is, you know, why doesn't it go to zero? Even when you do things like on an Office 365 tenant, block legacy authentication. And it's because we're incredibly bad at thinking of passwords. And we're also, in a lot of cases, unable to shut down these legacy protocols that let attackers endlessly iterate and try things, even when we do change the game slightly and end up with better passwords that change less often.
It's funny, right? I only became aware of the EWS stuff like recently. That was like last year sometime. And I'm like, oh, because it's everywhere, right? And it's like you cannot 2FA it.
Absolutely. And I think we're at the point where we're maybe 18 months into this. People really started seeing this at the beginning of 2018 really have an impact in terms of compromised accounts, then being used to attack business partners, then being used to attack other internal users. It was really brutal set of things to try and deal with because the root cause of the issue is difficult to grapple with. There was always some legacy application that relied on EWS or relied on IMAP, and you simply couldn't turn off for the sake of the business. So we found that actually doing monitoring of the Office 365 security APIs is an important control in kind of living in a world where you can't be perfect from an MFA perspective in most organizations. If you do get there, that's fantastic. But for most shops, you didn't really understand, you know, much like you didn't, that EWS runs all these incredibly important processes that you just can't turn off.
I mean, it would be nice to move to a, you know, block after 10 failed logins type of model, right? Like lock that account. Is that an easy thing to do?
Unfortunately, it's not. Is Office 365 makes this complicated in a variety of different ways. There are things like conditional access, and if you're paying for AD Azure P2, the vagaries of Microsoft licensing are well beyond the scope
of this conversation. I'm amazed that as an external company, you're able to actually understand it at all. That's very impressive, I imagine. You know, you've got a whole research division just working on that, but go on.
We've absolutely had to, because frankly, you know, there's a lot of things that are just not possible unless you have those features. And when most of our customers have moved to Office 365, you know, they've moved the threats, they've moved the data, and we have to figure out kind of what things that even we can hook into to try and leverage. But we're not really even at the point from an Office 365 perspective where most people block in just simple geofencing ways. You know, when we look at the IMAP attacks, you know, 63% of the attacks that we saw that were successful originated from Nigerian IP addresses. So not really working very hard on the OPSEC, on the attacker front there. South African infrastructure was actually number two, which was about 21%. And VPNs and anonymization services that all generally appear to be coming from the United States was third. We do see Tor in that. We do see some other kind of long-tail VPN services. But a lot of it actually seems to be launched even from things like compromised routers. And Microsoft has some really good tools here, but they put it entirely on you as a customer to configure all of this, to understand the licensing, to actually then try and deploy all of these controls to reduce this activity. And even then, you might not be able to get to a perfect defensive posture. So monitoring, again, becomes really important.
It's amazing to me how much of Proofpoint's success simply rests in filling the gap on Microsoft stuff.
It is really extraordinary. It's been the driver of our growth
like
for like
half a
decade. If they could
get their shit together, you'd be in real trouble there, right?
You're absolutely right. I think and that's true, of course, across a couple of different vectors. And over here, we're talking about sort of the what's known, Gartner called the CASB space, which is a name that somewhat unfortunately has stuck. But just figuring out what matters from a cloud security perspective, the attack surface changes in really kind of predictable ways. You will see these password spraying attacks. You will see phishing attacks. You will see spoofing attacks, you'll see malware. Microsoft has tooling for all of this, but none of it seems to be terribly effective.
So hang on, just to tie this back to what we're talking about, you are offering some sort of cloud authentication broking service as part of your email security suite now, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's Gartner calls this the cloud access security broker space. Basically, it's either sitting in front of cloud applications as a forward or reverse proxy, more often actually connecting via API. And doing the exact same sorts of things that we're doing on the email channel, basically threat protection and DLP
and
information
protection. It makes a lot of sense, right? But there's an awful lot of CASB players out there, right? And a lot of good ones as well. I just commented recently on that in last week's show, actually. There's quite a few. But look, one other question that I wanted to ask you while I've got you here is what's going on with ransomware? We had Sherrod DeGrippo, your colleague, on the show last year, and she said, look, ransomware as a mass email thing kind of dropped off big time. It's really weird, but it's basically just gone away. And it did seem like things did quieten down quite a lot. Now we've seen a whole bunch of high-profile breaches, ransomware breaches. And I say that because it feels like, and I'm just operating on intuition, this is why I'm asking you, but it feels like maybe they were manual intrusions where someone's got in and manually sort of ransomware stuff once they were in the network. But I just wondered if you've seen an uptick again in ransomware via email.
No, I think you're spot on. I think there are those who call this big game hunting style ransomware. Looking at the data, which is in front of me right now, ransomware as a payload is the lowest that we've ever seen it, actually.
Yeah. So like even Norsk Hydro was probably a group of people who targeted Norsk Hydro.
Exactly. You had those groups that were using RDP that was open to the internet and looking for that. There was a couple of other threat
resisting
actors.
Resisting urge to say you deserve it if you're exposing RDP, because no one deserves it. We don't victim shame here, but geez, ouch.
No, but it's so much of this just comes back to basic hygiene. Right? Yeah. But in this case, we are not seeing the massive ransomware campaigns, at least going via email, that we used to, because they're not profitable. A lot of that has to do with the price of Bitcoin, the ability to launder Bitcoin, but it's just not making money for them the same way. And frankly, we're seeing that in the rest of the landscape as well. There's a move towards much more targeted attacks in general, because selling on access, if I have, Emotet or something, any kind of first stage downloader, malware's gotten really, really modular in this respect. It is easier for me to sell that access for somebody than to monetize it via the traditional kind of self-service pay.
Well, it's just an extension of stuff we've seen over the last 20 years, right? People just getting more and more specialized. And it would make sense that finally you're just going to have one group that just does the finance stuff.
Yeah. And one of the best examples of that for me is a group that we call Threat Actor 505. They were DryDex way back in the day. They were the big ones behind Locky and lots of other quite famous malware families. They moved to actually dropping rats, which was really fascinating, right? Because, you know, a rat isn't something that you kind of automate the way a banking Trojan or traditional ransomware works. You know, you kind of need somebody with hands on keyboard to actually use that. So they had, there's this remote access product called AMI that they backdoored. So flawed AMI was the name of the malware they were using. And they've really actually kind of scaled that operation. They just drop rats in a lot of different places. And the only thing that we can think that they're doing to monetize that is just simply sell that access onto somebody who's interested in access into a particular organization or a particular type of organization.
Ryan Callenber, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Biz. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you about all of this stuff. Very interesting. And I'll look forward to our next conversation.
Pleasure as always, Patrick.
That was Ryan Callenber there of Proofpoint. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Proofpoint for being a Risky Business sponsor. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with a soapbox edition from Signal Sciences. Check that one out if web security is something you have to worry about. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.